Hello and a very warm welcome to an extra special edition of Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. On today's show, we invite you to sit back, relax and enjoy a selection of the best interviews and reports that have featured on Section D over the past year.
Coming up...
Finding young emerging architects, for me, is the reason that competitions are so positive and successful, because they are all about talent.
Some tips on how to run a successful architecture competition.
Former REBA president Angela Brady's take on the position of women in architecture.
Architects are trained in the same way, whether you're a woman or a man. But it's the perception of some people that still carry prejudices that, you know, it's like people used to think of women drivers. Oh, she's a woman driver. It's just stupid.
Former Monocle parishioner and all-round lovely man Hugo MacDonald also tells us how best to live in a city.
It's important to bring the city that you live in to a tangible mass rather than thinking of it as something intangible or something cold. To think of it as something human.
All that coming up, plus much more, right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show.
Well, Henry Rhys Sheridan, here we are. It must be the end of the year when we've run out of ideas enough to pull together some things which we've already covered. People have already heard this. Why are they listening?
They're listening, I think, in order to get an overview of what's happened in design over the last year. And also, I think this show is going to give listeners a good opportunity to compare and contrast different developments across fields in design. I know that we have themed shows every week. We try to look at a different facet of the design gemstone. Here, we bring some different facets together in one place so people can get a good idea of what's been going on. So this first item is an interview with Malcolm Redding. He's the head of Malcolm Redding Consultants, who's the leading independent organiser of architectural competitions in the UK. And I think, having spoken to many architects for Section D over the course of the last year and before then, one thing that has become really clear is that competitions are a really prominent feature of the architecture landscape, both in terms of the industry at large, in terms of deciding what gets built and where, but also, you know, in the lives of individual architects. They spend a lot of time applying to competitions, submitting designs, drawing up designs. And I think a general awareness of the competition landscape is a prerequisite nowadays for a practicing architect. So we got Malcolm into the studio to talk to us a little bit about what it takes to design a good architecture competition. Here he is.
Architectural competitions are as old as buildings themselves, because they've always been a way of commissioning great architecture. I imagine they had one for the pyramids, I'm not sure about that, but they certainly had one, for instance, for the Houses of Parliament in the 1850s, for the rebuilding of the Houses of Parliament. And they're always usually either very large public buildings, but we've run competitions for tiny cafes, so it's a whole range of different building types.
And so one would imagine that if we cast our minds back to these great public builds, these iconic buildings, what you needed to do basically was impress the king or impress the person to whose legacy this building would, become part. But I'm glad to say that in recent years there's been a more formal process for architectural competitions. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your work as a designer of them and basically how they work. I think people are very intrigued to know a bit more about them.
Well, you're absolutely right. Commissioning buildings is much more complex than it was in the past. Usually one single promoter or client and picked his or her architect and got on with it. But you've got projects now, particularly in London, for instance, where you've got these very large pieces of the city which are being rebuilt. They're more than just architecture. They're urbanism, landscaping, placemaking, and therefore finding an architect or finding a professional team for that who have a wide range of experience, some international experience as well, is a critical thing for clients nowadays. Normally what happens in a competition process is that there'll be some sort of either a very open process, which is please bring me your designs, and you get hundreds of designs and pick one that you like, but more normally now it's a structured process where there's a pre-selection of architectural teams and then setting them a design challenge, picking a winner and moving on with that. And that's very much the sort of competition that we tend to run.
I suppose last year, the idea of the architectural competition got a bit of a shake-up with the Guggenheim Helsinki.
Yes.
And most people will be familiar with the Guggenheim in Bilbao, which is, has an effect named after it, the revitalising effect of having one of these galleries in your city. But it was an open competition. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about its popularity and what that says about architectural.
Well, I think if you mention the word Helsinki and Guggenheim to most architects, they go weak at the knees. These are two. Firstly, the Guggenheim in New York is such an iconic building by Frank Lloyd Wright, but also designing in Helsinki. And we had this fantastic site in Helsinki on the South Harbour. And Helsinki is such a great design capital and such a great legacy of design that I think it attracted really fantastic interest from across the world. You're absolutely right. We had 1,700 entries, the biggest architectural competition in recent history. Quite importantly, I think, the Guggenheim was looking for a new architect. So we had a conversation with the Guggenheim about the sort of architect they were looking. And, you know, some people said, well, why don't you just appoint Frank Gehry? He's done the other ones. Why bother? But actually, what the Guggenheim was looking was for the next model architect. And therefore, this was a search for new talent.
So this particular project is a French-Japanese studio. That's right. And a small studio. But I wonder, the word competition implies fairness. But I very much doubt that the judges on that panel had a huge amount of time to go through that number of entries. Are these competitions fair, or are they a way of discerning something which the developer wants?
Well, in this particular case, it was strictly fair. And we had a jury of 11, and we designed a series of games, in some ways, games to help the jury get into the designs. They looked at some schemes before they came. We paired them up with each other. So the first 2 days was spent really working as pairs and working as small groups to refine and go through all of the schemes. Every single scheme was seen by every single juror. That was very important. But I would say, actually, picking from six is just the same as picking from 1,700. It's the same sort of challenges and debates and dialogue that one has. I believe at the heart of it, that's why I think competitions are such a fantastic way of commissioning buildings, because they are, by definition, fair and transparent, and they are judged by your peers. And if they're well organized, they come out with a fantastic result.
That was Malcolm Redding, the head of Malcolm Redding Consultants, a leading independent organiser of architectural competitions based right here in the UK. And Henry, we won't linger on this, but I think the interesting thing about architectural competitions and why we came to this is just how fraught they can be and how controversial they can be. We've seen the Guggenheim in Helsinki, massive, rapturous hatred and applause in equal measure for the various projects that came out of that. And actually, I think, you know, some people question whether architectural competitions are a good way of doing these things, whether it's good to have your whole studio devoted to trying to design a building that may never be built. What have you learnt this year?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point. I think the passing of Zaha Hadid earlier on this year really gave pause for thought in that regard, because, you know, she was a firebrand architect whose career, unfortunately, was defined to a certain degree by her locking horns with the establishment. She won a few commissions, then either proved extremely difficult for her to realise or were taken away from her completely. The Tokyo Stadium comes to mind in that regard. I think it was in light of her passing that we decided to dedicate an entire show to women in architecture. Now, many people might think that that's a controversial move, and indeed, our next interviewee, Angela Brady, the Dublin-born architect, one of the points that she makes is that we need to stop calling female architects and just referring to them as architects.
Women are horrendously underrepresented in architecture. There's not equal pay across the board in terms of studies that are done on graduates and postgraduates and people trying to apply the trade within it. So we sat down with Angela Brady, the former president of REBA and principal of Brady Malyoux Architects, to hear her take on the state of women in architecture.
Zaha Hadid was our star, our role model. She was a strong woman, and there was no need for her to say, I'm a woman architect, you know, because that automatically brings in, do men say, I'm a man architect? Architects are trained in the same way, whether you're a woman or a man. We have the same skills, but it's the perception of some people that still carry prejudices in this day and age that, you know, it's like people used to think of women drivers. Oh, she's a woman driver. It's just stupid. In medicine and in law, the kind of equality is much better. And I think that maybe it's because they are professions that don't have a male domination. Like on building sites, we're always dealing with contractors. And I think that's great as a woman. It's to my advantage in many ways because I have very good communication skills. And it's very easy for me to get the right finish with a bricky or blocky because they want to be respected as well as I want to be respected.
So do you think women in architecture, actually there's a kind of practical side when you're doing a building that there might be a certain forcefulness associated with being male, whether that's true or not, we can debate till the cows come home. Do you think men are perceived to be better at these things, or do you think that is an attitude which is, thankfully, you know, we're coming to undermine and people are realising that it shouldn't be a male-dominated industry?
It's male-dominated mainly because when women get to the age of having babies, which for architecture is 34 years of age, there's not enough support from their partners generally. And not necessarily their male architectural partners, but from their partners. And I think that until men actually take more responsibility with child rearing, that we're always going to have that problem where women take a couple of years out maybe to have children because the cost of a nanny or a childminder is quite a lot when we are the lowest paid of all the professions. So it's to do with low fees, to do with low salaries, to do with childcare. And that is the biggest obstacle that we women have. And it shouldn't be there.
And you've done a tremendous amount for raising people's awareness and education of this inequality. But I wonder if you can, in broad brushstrokes, tell us how it's changed over the decades since you yourself received your training to today, where we can be a bit more circumspect about the role of women in architecture. What's the trajectory?
There are definitely more women in architecture than there were. When I graduated, we were 10%. We're now 24%, and that's good. Not good enough, really. In schools of architecture, we're about 50-50, but there is still the dropout rate, and the same amount of men actually drop out of architecture as women do from the education side. It's also a very good education to be educated for 5 years in architecture, because then you can diversify into many things, from journalism to teaching to other professions in the built environment. Things are changing for the better. We did a wonderful exhibition that went to 34 countries around the world called Diverse City. And our aim was not to moan about being women architects, but to say, hey, we're great. Look at what we're doing. Look at all these fantastic buildings we're designing. And then there was also a little vox pop area on the panels that we had put up. And that was, what are the three things that you want to change? What would you tell younger people coming into the profession if they want to go for architecture? What advice would you give them? Because I think the best thing that women architects can do is help other women architects. But without saying, hey, you know, you're a woman architect, expect it to be tough. Let's go out there with a really positive attitude and say, we are architects. We shouldn't have to say women architects, just like men don't.
So a little bit of it is consciousness raising, but I'm always intrigued by the practicalities of implementing these ideas. So you're a director at Brady Malyoux Architects. You build contemporary sustainable buildings all over London and further afield. What are the practical steps that people who own businesses, who run businesses can do? Is it about taking chances on women architects? Should I not be saying taking chances? You know, is it about just representing women better in the workplace? What are the practicalities of doing so, do you think?
Practicalities are what certainly the big firms, the larger firms who employ over 50 architects, they can have women directors. They can make women directors or associates at an earlier stage on an equal playing field or on equal terms as their male counterparts. And there aren't enough. And one of the reasons is that women architects, it has been shown but from research, women architects don't come forward enough. They don't come forward for pay rises. And the recent AJ Architects Journal survey pointed out that women are paid less than men in many situations in architecture. I think that's totally wrong. It's also against EU employment law. So I would ask people, and when I give talks, you know, all around the UK or around Europe, I say, if you're not being paid, find out what your male counterparts are being paid and ask for a pay rise. If you don't ask, you won't get.
That was Angela Brady, OBE, director of London-based Brady Malyoux Architects and former president of REBA.
Still to come on the show, we speak to two design-minded writers about books they released this year. First up, though, a former Monocle man, Hugo MacDonald, gives us some tips on how best to live in a city. Then writer Cassia St. Clair tells us all about the secret lives of colours.
Plus, trailblazing architect Tom Kundig joins me in the studio to talk about sustainability in architecture. Stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's the Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in the Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
So, Henry, we've got one of my favourite interviews of the year coming up, mainly because Hugo MacDonald, a former design editor here at Monocle, a brand strategist, a former brand director of Studio Ilse, the talented designer Ilse Crawford's London-based studio, came in to talk about his very first book, a very thoughtful little number about how to live in a city, in this kind of vein of self-help books, but in a much more kind of practical way, about the fact that we as human beings are slightly divorced from the natural environment in which we would normally live in. I'm thinking the grasslands of Africa. People may wish to disagree with me. But also about how we relate to the city around us, the built environment. And I just think he speaks in a very lucid, a very nice, a very kind of emotional and tactful way about it.
I totally agree. It was one of my favourite interviews too. And I also think that Anna Kuba, who is a photographer who's worked with Monocle, did some great photography for this book. So there were two Monocle alumni involved in this book. And it's a great little volume. I think that, as you say, it kind of transcends the genre that it's in by kind of providing both a conceptual framework with which to approach living in a city, but also giving some very practical and hands-on tips about how you might realise that.
I was approached by the School of Life back in May last year, which happened to coincide with a series of fairly flagrant op-ed pieces in the British press about the death of the creative classes in London and the fact that everybody was being pushed out of the city. And as people tend to do, they piled into the comments section and weighed in, and everybody was having a go at London and at city life in general. And I thought, well, actually, there's a lot to be celebrated in cities. There's a lot to be celebrated in London. It's maybe time that we shed some of the things that we get used to just assuming that city life can be really difficult. And I'm not denying that it can be very difficult at times, but there is so much joy to be had as well. And so I saw this book as an opportunity to try and bring out a few of those opportunities to see the joy again.
And in broad brushstrokes, can you tell us about how you kind of countered some of these problems? There's one bit which I particularly liked, which is about forging actually a physical connection with architecture. Can you tell me what that means?
And, you know, this is something that a lot of people have picked up on, actually, which is I very early on in the book say that it's important to bring the city that you live in to a sort of tangible mass rather than thinking of it as something intangible or something concrete and something cold, to think of it as something human. And I advise that you go out and you touch buildings that you like and that you close your eyes and you try and feel them in some way as sort of repositories of energy of the past, of culture. And through feeling them, it's really a way of actually bringing the city into your hand quite literally, but obviously sort of the exercise itself is metaphorically intended.
And if we move the city a little bit further away, so we're maybe looking at it across a road, I mean, you say that typography says a lot about a city, that the abruptness or the prohibitions, the way in which people kind of identify how they want you to behave with the city, say a lot about it. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. This is another thing that people have picked up on, is I compare New York, which gives very strict, quite concise, indicative signs and actions through its street signs. It says walk, it says don't walk, you're instructed how to move through the city very clearly. London is a little bit more like a sort of bossy Victorian governess where you're told constantly what you're not allowed to do. And if you just open your eyes and look at street signs as you go about your daily life in the city, you begin to realise in different cities they really do have a very different character. Something that we've written about at Monocle actually was the Ample Mansion in East Berlin, who is the natty little chap that helps people cross roads. And his character is something that really brings the streets of East Berlin to life in some way.
Absolutely. And in Vienna, they redid the traffic lights for the Eurovision Song Contest to have same-sex couples on them. So you can read in this kind of like liberal take on how city life can work. One thing you also talk about, and you don't go as far as advising that we smash the looms, but there is what could be accused as a Luddite's take on technology, and that we should live in the moment and be a bit more vital about our kind of city experiences. What do you think about that? Should we be aspiring to a more analogue existence?
I have done a lot of observing in the course of first researching and writing this book, but ever since, it's sort of an ongoing thing for me. And the thing that horrified me more than anything was just seeing the sheer volume of people on their phones the whole time. And it's not just people using idle moments on public transport. It's people walking across Waterloo Bridge at sunset, maybe listening to the Kinks, I don't know, but just with their faces buried in their phones at a time where really if they put their phone in their pocket, even took out their headphones maybe, and just had a look at the wonder of the city around them in that moment, I think doing that even once a day can significantly increase the happiness that you feel and the connection that you feel to your city. So I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination that I don't think technology aids our life in the city. I think there are a million and one apps that really reduce the friction and enable us to really enjoy living in the city a lot more. But I don't think we should be a slave to our phones to the extent that we are at the moment.
That was writer and brand consultant Hugo MacDonald, author of How to Live in the City, which was published by Pan Macmillan on behalf of the School of Life in 2016.
So, Josh, we're going to speak to another writer now, Cassia St. Clair, and she wrote this fascinating book that came out earlier this year, The Secret Lives of Colour. She joined me in the studio to have a chat about it.
When I think about ultramarine, which is the colour that you usually see the Virgin Mary wearing in Renaissance portraits of her, I almost think about it like a sound, which sounds odd. But to me, when I look at her robes and they're painted this beautiful midnight blue, it reminds me of a bell, like a church bell, the sound, that really sort of, I always call it a sonorous blue. It just has that depth and sort of solemnity to it. And it's a beautiful colour. But also how it got to Europe is fascinating. So most of the ultramarine that you see in Western art, and there's a lot of it, it was a very highly prized pigment, particularly after it became associated with the Virgin Mary from around the 14th century. It all came, or most of it came, from a single source, a single mine in Afghanistan, in northeastern Afghanistan, and then was hacked out of a particular mountain in the form of lapis lazuli, which is a mixture of minerals. We now think of it as a semi-precious stone, and was carried across the Silk Route by camel or donkey, and then eventually put on ships and taken to Venice, and from Venice was traded throughout Europe. But it just had the most difficult journey to even get into Europe. And then by the time these lumps of rocks arrived in Europe, the process still wasn't over, because you'd buy your lump of ultramarine, of lapis lazuli rather, and then you'd have to grind it up, and then you'd have to purify it. And purifying it was, again, a very long, complicated process. You had to grind it down, and you had to remove the impurities by sort of, there's a wonderful artist's manual that was published by a man called Cennino Cennini, and he describes it like kneading dough. You had to grind the lapis lazuli down, mix it with all these different ingredients, and then knead it like dough in a solution of lye, and the blue lazulite would sort of fall out of this mixture and collect at the bottom, and then you'd be able to use that as a pigment.
We're now going to move on to a colour with an altogether more morbid history, Sheila's green.
Yes, again, this comes out of this idea of some colours being very, very difficult to produce. And when you do find a source for it, you're sort of prepared to overlook considerable downsides. In this case, there hadn't been very many colour-fast greens ever. And in 1775, a Swedish chemist creates one. And it's, to them, a very vibrant green, nothing like it had been produced before, and it became immensely fashionable. He was called Carl Wilhelm Scheele, and he called the green after himself. And it was used on artificial flowers, it was used on wallpapers, on dresses, even in confectionery. But it contained a lot of arsenic, and it was used in vast quantities. And it took quite a long time for people to start raising the alarm. And by the time they did, it was sort of too late. In the late 19th century, the Times estimated that between 500 and 700 tons of this colour were being produced annually in England alone, and it was popular all over Europe. And like I said, it was being used in homes and in very sort of everyday situations, and people were becoming sick and dying. There was a very sad case of a little girl who'd been given a bunch of artificial grapes and had been seen, as all very small children do, putting them in her mouth and sucking off the green colour, and she very sadly died. And there were lots of artificial flower workers who died as well, and the symptoms were very varied, and so it took quite a long time for people to put two and two together and to realise what was happening.
And finally, I've saved perhaps the most fascinating colour till last. We're going to speak about Vanta Black. What is Vanta Black?
Well, it's not strictly a colour. It's actually a nanomaterial, which can be, sounds rather alarming, grown onto surfaces. But if you imagine Vanta Black, Vanta stands for vertically aligned nanotube array, and it's rather like a field of straws, only each straw is about 10,000 times thinner than a human hair and 1,000 feet tall. And light hits this field of straws and gets trapped in all the little gaps and nooks and crannies and bounces around and just gets lost. And this means it has an astonishing power to absorb visible light, far more than any other man-made material. It absorbs, I think, 99.965% of visible light. And this makes it incredibly uncanny. I actually went to the lab where they make it in Surrey, and it looks like a mistake. That's the best way to put it. They showed it to me on a crumpled up piece of tin foil, and you look at the back of the tin foil and you can see it's rumpled. You get that 3D effect of the gleam of the tin foil and the dark areas where the light doesn't fall. And then you turn the tin foil over and you just see a flat black disc, and there's no reflection. You cannot see three-dimensionality. It looks like a mistake. It was created with a very specific small use case in mind. When I went to go and interview Ben Jensen, who is the man behind Surrey Nanosystems that created this material, they had initially thought that what it'd be used for was very small aerospace technology, and it would be used in sort of imaging systems and in instruments in satellites. And actually, it has subsequently been used in a CubeSat that was launched just before Christmas. However, when they launched it in July 2014 and they went to a trade fair and they sort of expected a few people would be interested and maybe in 10 years' time it might make it into space when it had been through all the tests, they discovered that people were blown away by the fact this was the blackest thing ever, and were blown away by the fact that visually it is just such a bizarre thing to look at. And people just had this incredible reaction to it. And they were mobbed by people who wanted to use it on all sorts of things, from watches and jewellery and whole buildings. So it really captured people's imagination, not always in a good way. They told me that they had some calls from some people who were saying that this is so black that it must be the work of the devil.
Cassia St. Clair there, whose book The Secret Lives of Colour was published in October by John Murray. I'd implore you to go out and buy a copy.
Josh, what are your thoughts on the concept of sustainability in architecture? Because I know that the concept can have perhaps unwanted associations with dreadlocks and hemp.
I completely agree with you. My slightly counterintuitive take, not as a practitioner, but as someone that writes and criticises, not in the sense that it tries to undermine, but in the sense that tries to understand and elucidate the meanings behind things. My feeling is slightly anachronistic that, you know, we do see sustainability around us in, say, London's terraced Georgian houses that were built, you know, over 100 years ago and are still standing. And I don't always see sustainability in LEED certified buildings that look ugly and grubby and need to be knocked down after 10 or 20 years. So I think the idea of sustainability does need to be interrogated in a manner that is not always done. Yes, it shouldn't leak heat. No, it shouldn't be made in a way that releases a lot of toxins into the environment. But also there's this idea that we should think a little bit more carefully about the style of a building. I mean, do people want to live in glass boxes? I don't think they do. So there are some things that we should take from older buildings and we could inbuild them into newer buildings and understand that sustainability is a style and is a cultural thing as much as it is a certificate on a piece of paper. I don't know if you agree with me.
I completely agree with you, Josh. And I think this next guest would too. He's been thinking about sustainability a lot throughout his long career. Tom Kundig, he's a principal at the Seattle-based architecture firm Olson Kundig, which this year celebrated its 50th anniversary. He joined me in the studio to talk about his career and to talk about sustainability in architecture.
Sustainability has been in the business of architecture for many, many years. It's not just this recent sort of surge, almost like a reactionary surge to what I think is becoming more clearer and clearer an issue for us, a survivability of the earth. In the 50s and 60s, you had Buckminster Fuller trying to figure out how to make light structures and less material-centric structures. You certainly had discussions about how to place buildings and sort of reduce air conditioning loads or heating loads and sort of the placement of how a building faces the climatic conditions of where it's located. That conversation has been going on for many, many years. I think what's changing is there's a better understanding of what sustainability means, because it's not just technology that's sustainable. It's actually still, it continues to be, how do you build smart? How do you build like our ancestors did when you didn't have an air conditioning or you didn't have a grid to basically power your heating system or your air conditioning system? And basically, you might not have even had, of course, our ancestors didn't have lighting either. You know, how do you design a building so it needs less and less artificial light and engages, or it sort of harvests natural daylighting better? I think those issues are becoming more part of all architects' thinking, more now than ever before, because there are systems in place that almost sort of force those decisions. And then there's just a little bit more of a sensitivity with an understanding of why we make those decisions that we make. One of the things that I think is quite interesting, and I think this is an indictment of the building industry in general, is that I think still to date, and this is, I'm speaking from somewhat of a naive standpoint on this, I still don't know if we know what sustainability means in the building of buildings. In other words, how do we actually quantify the true embodied energy of a building? As an example, if you have a solar panel on your building and it is imported from China, obviously there's embodied energy of the fabrication, the material handling, the fabrication in China, and then the transportation of that piece. And there are some programs that recognize gathering materials within 50 miles of the project is actually, that meets some goals. It's a very complex equation. It's an algorithm that it is like many pages long in a sense. Maintenance, as an example. Wood is obviously a very sustainable material because wood actually, as you grow it, is actually a plant, which is actually cleaning the air. But once it's cut and once it's harvested and something is made out of it, wood is a relatively high maintenance material that requires a lot of people coming back over the lifetime of the building to maintain it, to keep it from rotting, to put on sometimes volatile chemicals to keep it from rotting. So what is the real embodied energy issue of different types of materials? Concrete, high initial embodied energy, obviously, or steel. Well, done correctly, concrete can last, 100 years, 200 years.
That was Olson Kundig, founder and Seattle-based architect Tom Kundig, who recently published his third book with Princeton Architectural Press, entitled Tom Kundig Works.
Still to come, we take on logo design in fashion, head to Sheffield to profile Europe's largest listed building, and, of course, an in-depth discussion of chair copyright law with the CEO of legendary Danish furniture company Carl Hansen and Son. Stay tuned.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
So, Josh, we decided to cover in some detail earlier in the year the concept of logos in design. And I know that they are a fraught topic for many people. There's something that tends to trigger fairly extreme reactions in either direction. And I think there's no field where this is more true than in fashion. Logos being in trend, being out of trend, the prominence of logos, their colour, the way different brands use them is something which is constantly talked about in that world. And it's something that we wanted to have an intelligent conversation about. So we enlisted Monocle's perhaps most logo-friendly staffer, Fernando Pacheco, to speak to our next interviewee.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to fashion journalist Dana Thomas, the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. And here's the interview.
Let's look at the beginning. I mean, who were the first fashion designers that started to use logo in a prominent way?
I think the first was actually Chanel. Coco Chanel started putting the Chanel logo inside handbags, not on the outside. And then after her death, I think, maybe it was in the 60s or early 70s, somewhere in there, the Chanel company decided to move the logo to the outside of the bag. But in the old days, you put your own initials on the outside and you had the logo on the inside.
What do you think was especially in the beginning, the main purpose of the logo, do you think was something aspirational, perhaps?
No, it was actually a way of marking a company's trademark so you could know that it was the real thing. It was an anti-counterfeiting measure. And that's the irony of it, is that today the counterfeiters use the logos in order to make and sell their products. And Louis Vuitton started with its trademark sort of grid with the Japanese symbols as a anti-counterfeiting device, and that became their logo.
Let's talk a little bit about logo trends over time. For example, when I think about the 80s, I think that's when logos reached their peak. Would you agree with me?
I think so, though there was a time in the late 90s where it came pretty close to that peak again. The logo mania, and as a result also the counterfeiting in the late 90s, was really a little scary, and people were having counterfeiting parties, counterfeiting items sold at their homes, a bit like Tupperware. But in the 80s, yeah, it was pretty heavy. And it wasn't simply luxury brands, it was everything. It was Nike swooshes, and it was Rolex watches, and it was, across the board logos.
And now, again, I think things are changing, especially, I would say, perhaps in Europe, that actually logos are not that cool anymore. So you have to be kind of more understated. So I presume there's a difference between markets as well and how people use logos. I'm talking about today. What do you think?
Well, there was definitely a crash of logo mania in 2008 after the economic crash, because it just became very uncool to show your wealth, because so many people lost their wealth. And I'm not talking about the middle class, I'm talking about the super rich, the people who lost their wealth in the stock market, the people who lost their wealth because of Madoff. And so one did not show their wealth through mounting logos saying, I can afford this and therefore I'm wearing it. And it's been slow to return, in part because there's still a serious swath of the population that's suffering from the economic crisis. And it's just not good to rub it into people's faces. So it is far more discreet. And it's become more about craftsmanship as opposed to the stamp of the logo. It seems like there was a shift in the luxury and fashion industry where people started buying the brands for what they represented rather than what they actually were. That you bought a Chanel bag not because it was a really great Chanel, great made product, but because it had the double C on the front, or the quilting, which is a signature like a logo, or the same thing with a Louis Vuitton suitcase. You were buying the Rolly suitcase not because it was a particularly great Rolly suitcase, but because it had that logo, so it showed that you had flair and savoir-faire and money. But today that's less the case because so many people are suffering, and because of the disparity of wealth, the rich don't want to show off too much, and the middle class doesn't have the money to show off anymore.
Nearly at the end of the show now, Josh, nearly at the end of the year, indeed. And something that you mentioned in the queue to the last item was the fact that the dynamics of logo production and reproduction within fashion actually have a lot to do with the state of copycat designs at any given time. Earlier this year, there was a shock to the replica furniture industry when EU regulations came into effect in July that extended the copyright on furniture from 25 years to 70 years after the death of a designer. Now, this has profound implications for manufacturers of furniture which takes from original designs. Now, the UK managed to give retailers a 6-month transition period ending at the end of January next year in 2017. So if anyone does want to get their hands on some cut price furniture, they should do so now. But, you know, I think that a lot of the attention was devoted to what the effect on the retailers would be of this law, what the effect on the economy would be. Not much attention was given to the other side of things, why this law was coming into place. It ultimately was coming into place to protect people's intellectual property, and we thought it was important to address that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a mass market appeal for having something that looks a little bit like a Hans Wegner chair. And there are big companies, say Cassina or Knoll in Italy, who have the rights to the best furniture of the 20th century as decided on by the market and as decided upon by the people that buy them. Should people be allowed to open source that and, you know, steal the arms of a chair that looks famous and put it on a cut price website on, I won't name one, but I am moving house at the minute, so I am consulting some of them. You know, the intellectual property associated with these things, clearly in fashion, you know, there's a much more open source nature to these things. If you put out some big sleeves, then a company can copy that, and they'll put out some big sleeves, and, you know, it'll be in a lower price point, and it'll be a knockoff, and the people will move on to the next big thing they see on the catwalk shows, because they happen blissfully often. A Danish furniture designer who died 50 years ago is not making any more chairs. So the companies that own the rights to these classic legendary products that are sought after by architects, that are featured in interiors magazines, need to protect themselves. And that's why we spoke to our next guest. Bit of a scoop for us, actually. Well, I shouldn't say for us. We get a lot of great guests. But nude Erik Hansen, fully clothed, I might add, the CEO of Danish furniture manufacturer Carl Hansen & Son, spoke to us about how this affects his business.
We are reissuing it for many reasons, and the most important one is perhaps that it was the actual first chair we received from Hans J. Wegner in 1949, and it has some fantastic characteristics. You can see in the chair that inspirations for other chairs he has designed is actually present in that chair, and therefore it is a very unique, it's very, very unique chair, and of course also a difficult chair to make. But it is something which has a speciality for us because it is the absolute first chair we got. Today, of course, we produce the chair with exactly the same details as they did in those days. But we have a few more means to ease the process, because you have today fantastic machines, you have beautiful facilities which they didn't have in those days. So it's perhaps a little bit easier today, because if we were to do it the way they did it in 1950, we wouldn't be able to pay for the chair.
This manufacturing and these lovely new machines that you speak of are in your new facility in Gelsted in Denmark, a facility that you reinvested in 2014, and we covered that in the magazine. Now, you own the licenses, not only to this Hans J. Wegner chair, but many other classic furniture designs.
Yes.
There's recently been a new law passed in the UK extending the copyright protection of furniture designs from unlicensed manufacturer from 25 to 75 years. This is in response to the an acknowledgement of the drain that copycat manufacturing was having on the design of furniture industry. Is that an issue for your company?
It is, of course. I would say at the moment we are, of course, feeling the copying from the Far East, from China and other of the Far Eastern countries. The quality that they produce does not match what we are doing. And I can say they sell on price, and the only thing we don't sell at is a price. We are competing with others on quality. And therefore, there is a big difference between the two products. Although they look alike, they are certainly not alike. But it is annoying, especially in markets where we are making an entry, if the copies are already there. That is very, very annoying for us, because it is making life much more expensive for us and difficult, because people expect the low prices as well. So we are worldwide traders. We are not an enormous company. We are a small-sized company, and many of these copycats have companies that are much, much bigger and much more powerful than we are. And that is annoying as well. It actually is, we use a lot of money on lawyers and on refraining, getting people to understand what we stand for, which would have been different if there wasn't copies around. So we actually focus sometimes on something which we actually are not really in the mood of using for promoting our own products, but to try and keep the others away, and that's no fun.
That was Knud Erik Hansen, CEO of Danish furniture manufacturer Carl Hansen and Son.
So, Henry, we're ticking ever closer to the end of the year, end of the show. I feel like by saying that earlier, you've put us on a bit of a stopwatch. But I'd like to relax here for a second and discuss your frankly ridiculous desire to visit the north of England whenever possible on a reporting trip. I mean, you've been to Oslo this year, you've been to a number of obscure fairs in Germany, but, you know, given the opportunity to travel, your compass quite often points north and points to places like Sheffield. Can you tell me why that is?
So the first ever design report that I was sent on at Monocle was from David Pleasant when he was producing the show, and it was to Sheffield Design Festival. And I thought it was a little bit of an odd choice. That region of the world doesn't necessarily fall under Monocle's radar, perhaps as much as it should, you could argue. But I went up there for Sheffield Design Week back in 2015. I was really impressed both by the city in general and by what the organisers for the Design Week we're doing in particular. Now, obviously, the political events of this year have thrown up a lot of debate surrounding, you know, differences in culture between metropolitan centres and, you know, perhaps smaller cities or rural areas. And I think, you know, particularly in Britain, it's so easy to just completely ignore basically anywhere outside of London, not only in terms of politics and the economy, but also in terms of cultural clout. But, you know, the organisers of this Design Week in Sheffield were really kind of trying to establish a unique design identity for a city which, after all, has an astonishing design heritage rooted in industrial steel manufacturing and design of that nature. And, you know, not in a kind of bitter way, not in a way that they were feeling sorry for themselves that they've been left behind, but just trying to branch out to other European capitals, to other design centres around the world, not having to go via London. So that's how I fell in love with Sheffield as a design centre.
And it's amazing, you know, over the course of the year, there's a chance to look backwards, there's a chance to reflect. You know, the slip of a thing, the young lad that was so excited to go to Sheffield. You and I were in the studio a few weeks ago, and you were complaining about going to Cannes in the south of France. I mean, the levels of arrogance that have been achieved in production of this show are, you know, frankly, ridiculous.
It is. It is remarkable. I am fully hubristic now. But I decided to visit Sheffield again after my first visit in order to profile one very special building up there. This was part of our concrete episode. That is to say, an episode that looked at the material concrete and how it is used in design. So Park Hill is a massive housing estate up there, and it's actually the largest listed building in Europe. It's a huge brutalist structure with such a fascinating story behind it. And I went up there and had the privilege of chatting really to some of the finest architecture minds in the public and private sector in Sheffield about the story of this building and how it's intertwined with the story of the city, but also the story of post-war architecture in Britain.
What we're looking at now is unfinished concrete, essentially. So the pillars that we're stood next to, you can see how it was made, you can see the formwork where the wooden mould was. It's actually a design that connects a series of large tower blocks, essentially. Where we're stood now is we're surrounded by concrete structure. And to think of these once empty spaces being full of families and to hear, you know, children playing, it would have been a very much different kind of atmosphere. But yeah, it is slightly surreal now. It's kind of very Soviet-esque, I guess, in terms of its size.
Park Hill was opened in 1961, emerging out of a very specific social and political context. Satwinder Samra is the director of Future Practice and a senior university teacher at the Sheffield School of Architecture.
So Sheffield, as a lot of the country, was facing acute housing shortages. and we had conditions of poverty and quite a lot of slum conditions. And so post-war, there was a sense that we needed to lead in terms of new housing provision. So Sheffield, led by the chief city architect, decided that there needed to be a number of new housing schemes built within the city, one of which would be Park Hill. There was a political will, but that was backed up by a kind of a trust and an idea that architects had a social purpose. And at the time, leading architects, the must-have job would be working in local authorities. So there was a sense that one should provide for this kind of quite difficult need. And so at the time, the architects would work on proposals. And in particular in Park Hill, what was interesting was that the existing houses had street names and there were existing communities. And within the development of the new, there was this idea that they would try and keep the communities together through the design of the new. So the site's quite complicated in terms of its slope. And the proposal that they developed was very much one of thinking about how the architecture could respond, but in particular using or being influenced by kind of modernist principles of daylight, kind of the idea that the structure might have a certain sort of rigour to it, and also the materials, which for some people can be seen to be quite aggressive, and this idea of brutal can be quite problematic. But at the time, it was very much about offering views, offering daylight. The project had quite a sophisticated waste disposal system within it, and there was proper sanitation. So if you can imagine, you're going from a kind of Sheffield terrace, which might be quite cramped, quite dark, quite gloomy, not great sanitation, to something which is quite brave, which is almost like a nostalgia for the future.
Simon Ogden is head of city regeneration at Sheffield City Council.
What was special about Park Hill was not just the architecture, but the trouble that the team took to actually maintain the social structures of the families and streets that moved into those buildings. So there was actually a sociologist on the design team for Park Hill in the 50s who went round and found out who was related to everybody else in the slums and made sure that all those family groups were linked together and that whole streets, where possible, were moved onto the new streets. And that was one of the reasons why it worked so well. The success lasted quite a long time, really. I would say probably the first 30 years of its life, it was regarded as being a good place to live and was sought after. After that time, that first generation of families started to dwindle, and the kind of the way that they used Park Hill, where, you know, you see the pictures from the 60s where mums and grandmas used to sit outside the flats on and look after the kids, and, you know, people went in and out of their houses. As that generation moved on, people moved in who were a lot more private in their behaviour. I think that the maintenance of the blocks was not up to scratch, so people started to get fed up with lifts breaking down and smelling of pee and so on. I think there was also a kind of a learnt behaviour that people saw it just as being another high-rise block and therefore assumed that the behaviour that went along with that was kind of antisocial and rather selfish. So you got people moving in there and using it just as an address to pick up benefit or, you know, you got a different attitude towards it. It wasn't a place where people were moving with their family. It was just an address.
Despite its decline, in 1998, English Heritage controversially gave Park Hill Grade 2 listed status, making it the largest listed building in Europe. In 2004, developers Urban Splash were approached by Sheffield Council to redevelop the block. Simon Green is Executive Director of Place at Sheffield City Council.
We entered into a development agreement with the developers Urban Splash a few years ago now, and they are on our behalf refurbishing the Park Hill over a period of several years. We're currently towards the end of phase one. It was set back a little because of the clear global recession in terms of property, but now phase one is coming to an end. It's been very successful, and what we're seeing are a complete rebuild and refurbishment of living units and on the ground two floors commercial. And the commercial space is being let to very much an artistic and creative set of industries. And it's been quite a surprise, actually. Sheffield is very buoyant with regard to creative industries, but actually them relocating to those particular that particular part of the city was a surprise, a nice surprise. It has helped the financials and the viability of the project. It has also helped let and sell the units above the commercial activity.
Human Design Studio was the first business to move into one of the renovated commercial spaces at Park Hill. Nick Bax is their creative director.
The company's been going for 7 years, and before we were based in Globeworks, which is another Grade 2 listed building on the other side of the city, and it was actually an old cutlery works. It was a nice historic place to be, and we've been there 5 years and enjoyed being there. But I'd always had my eye on Park Hill, and I think, you know, it's just such an iconic place, and again, it's got a lot of history to it, and when we had a chance to come here, we jumped at it.
Do you think Park Hill's sexy?
I think it is. You know, I think it's because it's quite dangerous and daring, not as a location, but in terms of like an aesthetic.
Park Hill was born out of a post-war context that was optimistic, forward-looking, and relatively socially cohesive. The brave new world suggested by the building's brutalist aesthetic complemented this outlook, a kind of nostalgia for the future, as Stutwinder put it. The effort to redevelop the building is commendable, and certainly better than leaving it redundant or demolishing it. On one of the concrete bridges connecting the two blocks, there's a well-known bit of graffiti facing out to the city that outlasted the building's original residents. It reads, "Claire Middleton, I love you, will you marry me?" The words, "I love you, will you marry me?" have been overlaid in neon by Urban Splash and are beamed out over the city at nightfall. It's a nice touch, but to me is emblematic of the reappraisal of Park Hill and other once-derided British brutalist buildings in recent years, fueled not by a nostalgia for the future, but a plain nostalgia for what historian David Kynaston calls a better yesterday. For Monocle, in Sheffield, I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
That was Henry Rhys Sheridan reporting from Sheffield with a rather fabulous package. I don't know if it's been described as such before, but I'll leave that to linger. If you'd like to know more about modernism in Sheffield, then do visit modernistguides.com. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this special Best of Section D show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, the man behind the glass, Kieran Banerjee, all of our fantastic correspondents who across the year have brought us reports from all around the world, and of course, the man sat in Zurich, effectively opposite me, it's our show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you've got any comments or queries, then feel free to email me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week and next year at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you get the chance. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.